Blog Talk Radio.
That's right, we can't do it alone. We like to wake up everybody. We'd like to welcome you on the 14th day of August 2021 to MPH Radio. Our theme today is Visiting Venezuela and Learning. That's right, we're going to take a visit to Venezuela today, and we're going to learn something new. We have a special guest that we invited, Sister Cherie A. Dickerson, who just recently, not too long ago, came back from Venezuela, and she can give you a on-deck perspective, a hand-on-deck perspective of Venezuela, her perspective, and why it's important to learn about what's going on in Venezuela and its relationship to our daily lives. So at that point in time, later on this program, we will bring her in. But before we do that, like always on MPH Radio, we would like to first give you something to think about as it relates to this concept of freedom, followed by Black Minifacts from Susie, and then we will have a special message to the community from Alex Joyner. That will be the order of the day for this particular program. And we now will get started by encouraging you at this particular time to get a pen or a pencil and a paper, piece of paper. We'd like to give you something to think about. As we talk about getting you something to think about, we're going to talk about this concept of freedom. You know, freedom is a concept that many people have different perspectives. Millions and billions of people have died over this concept. People are still struggling today about they want freedom. So we would like to know what you think freedom is. So what we have done at this point in time, we're going to give you two short definitions of someone's perspective on freedom. Think about it later on during this program. The first definition came from Brother Malcolm X. He stated that you can't separate peace from freedom because no one can be at peace unless he has his freedom. What do y'all think about that? You cannot separate peace from freedom because no one can be at peace unless he has his freedom. Another concept, if you talk about freedom, that came from Brother Bob Marley. He stated that it's better to die fighting for freedom than to be a prisoner all the days of your life. Let me read that again to you. It's better to die fighting for freedom than to be a prisoner all the days of your life. So what y'all think about that definition of freedom? Hit us back later on during this program. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a brief break with music with a message. And when we come back, make sure you have your pen, your pad out. And soon we're going to give you some MPH Black Mini Facts for this week. This is MPH Radio. We'll be right back. Don't you go nowhere. This is Missing Pages of History. Right, learning to love yourself, love your people, and to love humanity is the greatest love of them all. We welcome you back to MPH Radio. At this point in time, we can bring Susie in. She will share with you for this week some Black Mini Facts. Susie, welcome to MPH Radio.
Good evening. I'd like to start with August the 8th, and the mini tracks are coming from the PRSP calendar of 2021. First, on August the 8th, Matthew Henson, African explorer and first to land on the North Pole, was born in 1866. Also, another mini fact is Zimbabwe, African National Union, was founded in 1963. On August the 9th, the International Day of Solidarity with the Women of South Africa and Namibia. That was a mini fact. And we had on the 10th, Josina Michelle Guerrero, organizer of Mozambique, FRELIMO's Women's Wing, was born in 1945. On the 11th of August, Africans in the U.S. set the city of Watts, California, ablaze in protest against the racist capitalist system in 1965. On the 12th, Samir Amin, African Marxist, died in 2018. Also on the 12th, the African Mine Workers Union organized 70,000 to strike against mine owners in South Africa in 1946. And on the 13th, Fidel Castro, president of Cuba, was born in 1926. And last, for the 14th of August week, Amos Jess, African biologist, was born in 1883. And the last and final mini fact for August the 8th through the 14th is the U.S. government issues warrants for the arrest of Angela Davis in 1970. There you have the mini facts for August the 8th through the 14th coming out of the PRSP calendar of 2021.
And also on that note, we'd like to add a little point of view of on August the 13th. I think it was 1956, Susie. We had Susie. We would like to wish her 56. A happy birthday. We would like to wish you a happy birthday for this year. Her birthday was on the 13th of August. And hopefully you have many more. So also happy birthday to you, Susie, on behalf of MPH Radio.
All right. Thank you.
All right, my listening audience, we're going to take a quick break with music with a message. When we come back, we have a special message to you from Alex Joyner, a message to the community. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio.
If you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you loved your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preachers? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming.
For you and for me, with just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
we'll make a better society.
And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right?
That's right. If you had a choice of color, which one would you choose? Welcome back to MPH Radio. We will continue our program by going to Brother Alex Joyner. He has his special message to the community. At this time, we will welcome our Brother Alex to MPH Radio. Welcome, Alex.
Well, thank you, Mr. Robinson. I would like to welcome the listeners and callers today to another positive and inspiring show. I thank the guest speaker and the commentators for their facts and information that they will present today. I also would like the staff of Missing Pages of History, especially you, Susie, today, my strong, beautiful, intelligent sister, and Mr. Robinson, for their endearing efforts to bring us the knowledge and missing history that most of us have not learned in the public education system. I have been over this past week engaged with many others on the concept of what is true freedom. Today, as we start our traditional school year, more teachers, students, and support staff are getting sick and dying. 4 people died of COVID-19 the same day in the same school district in Florida as the virus claims in it life, regardless of age or race. The opponents of mask wearing and the vaccinated are claiming any mandate is an infringement of their right to freedom of choice. They have no conscience of doing the right thing by making sure they are following the science or data that is available. What is best for our children and all others is simple. Wear a mask and get vaccinated. It is so simple that many can't believe they are helping the ones they love the most stay safe. Talk to your doctor and to someone who has been vaccinated. They are the ones who care the most about you and your community. We as a people must come together and find common ground among ourselves, or we will perish as separated foes in battle, in lies and falsehood, overwhelmed by tragic sickness and death. The true freedom we seek should be as one that began on August 14, 1791, on a small island in the Caribbean. From the teachings of the European Bible, the exodus of the Hebrew slaves from Egypt, they too, the brave stolen descendants of many countries from Africa to be free of bondage to another nation and won their liberty and justice for all. So let my people go. My first memory of people being in slavery and bondage within the movie, The Ten Commandments, with Charlton Heston but depicting the biblical Moses, shouted to Pharaoh, "Thus saith the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may worship me." It is a scene in my mind that I have treasured for life. People who were held in bondage by ones that mistreated and abused those who had been stolen, kidnapped, or taken as spoils of war. They were in servitude to others who thought of themselves as superior to another less fortunate. As I grew older, I treasured my Golden Legacy historical magazine, which featured the birth of Haiti as its first volume. I often wonder why it was chosen to be the first in a series of 16 volumes of black historical facts and figures. What did Leo Carter, the writer and artist, and the founder, Bertrand Fitzgerald Jr., in 1966, decided that the most important thing about black history in the United States was to publish the fight for the freedom of Haiti. Very few people have been taught that the Haitian Revolution was the largest and most successful rebellion by enslaved people in the Western Hemisphere. The revolution formally ended in 1804 with Haiti winning and declaring their independence from France as a colonial colony. This ended the forced childhood slavery and importation of new slaves to the country. Haiti became the first black republic in the world. For 21 years, the Haitian government itself and had diplomatic ties with many nations. Then France, in 1925, began to extort Haiti, forcing the new nation to pay the French colonial slaves for lost property. This amount calculated today the equivalent of more than $21 billion U.S. dollars. The Haitian government has been repaying this outrageous debt for over 120 years. The majority of Haitian budget has been this repayment until it was paid off in 1947. The Haitian government had borrowed money from many countries, including the United States, to satisfy this unjust request. To this day, the people of Haiti remain trapped by the immoral financial costs that other colonial powers continue to impose on them. The Center for Constitutional Rights, along with many worldwide organizations, have joined in the legal fight to return the unjustified debt and secure reparations back to the Haitian people. Haiti became the example for many nations to learn independence. The rich European nations saw this as a way to freedom for all the colonies they possessed. So instead of helping Haiti, they chose to punish the nation with embargoes and high tariffs so the Haitians would find their independence wrongful and return to servitude to the French, Spanish, England, or the newly formed nation of America. America never saw Haiti as a fair trading partner and sold its goods to Haiti at unfair prices. Then the U.S. government didn't allow goods from Haiti to be unloaded and sold to America. Many years of misinformation and distrust has been shown to Haiti by many nations, including the U.S. The Haitian people have suffered for centuries and pleaded to the world for help with trade and investment plans that would make the nation prosperous. The European arrogance that a black country wanted freedom to decide their own government, justice, and financial success was too much to support for many countries who had promoted slavery for years. Outside of the shores of Africa, the black race was a threat to any European country whose belief that they were superior to all other races as they sought to invade and conquer all the lands of the New World. In the midst of the battle for freedom, many blacks died to free Haiti of French rule. The blacks did not back down or flee. They fought the French with the help of other inhabitants of the island. Slaves, along with free mulattoes, former Frenchmen, Spanish, British citizens, and Polish natives, fought side by side to ensure the independence of Haiti. It is seen as a defining moment in the history of the new Atlantic world. Its effect was felt throughout the Americas and began to call for the end of slavery in many countries. The European beliefs about allegedly black inferiority and the newly freed slaves' ability to govern themselves was challenged by the new leaders of Haiti as they proved to welcome the task. Haiti became a well-respected country with a strong government despite all the hate and embargoes against the nation. Freedom is deserved by all men as a God-given right, as no man is born a slave to any man. We cry for justice in the jail as we do in the streets of America. We are overlooked and dismissed by some and even criticized by our own to say we ask for too much. Respect and reparation come hand in hand to the table of freedom. We cannot rise and live up to our full greatness while others do all they can to suppress and distress us as they do Haiti even today. For the Haitian people's fight is all our fight. We are brothers locked into an everlasting struggle to free ourselves of past and present misgivings, of persecution and misinformation of our historical past, that we have fought to be free men from the first day our ancestors were brought here by force and chains to America. I speak to the nation of the world today, as Moses spoke to Pharaoh, let my people go. We have been in poverty, fear, injustice, ignorance, and mental distress since we were stolen from our homeland. We have been given only the scraps of freedom, as others have profited off our forced servitude. Do you have no shame? Again, I say, my people go. And I thank you, Sam.
Right. Thank you, Brother Alex, for your commentary. And to our listening audience, all views and commentary are independent of this radio station and its members. So at this point in time, we want to do a quick station break, music with a message. And when we come back, we're going to take on our theme today, Visiting Venezuela and Learning, with our special guest, Sheree A. Dickerson. This is MPH Radio, and we'd like to encourage all of our underserved community and people to get up and stand up for your rights.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Don't give it up, don't give it up.
Get up, stand up.
Get up, stand up.
Stand up.
right. We're going to get up and stand up for our rights. Welcome back to MPH Radio. At this point in time, we're going to make our transition to today's theme, which is visiting Venezuela and learning. And we're going to do this by talking to our sister, Sharia Dickerson, who is a representative of Black Lives Matter in Oklahoma City. And she recently took a trip to Venezuela, and she will come and share with us some of the things she learned and saw and try to give us a better understanding on not only what's going on in Venezuela, but its relationship to our daily people, lives, and movement. So right now, we are very honored to bring in Sister Sharia in, and we'd like to welcome her to MPH Radio. And Sister Sharia, welcome, and can you just briefly tell people a little something about who you are?
Yes, good morning, and thank you to everyone who is listening, who will listen, and that we are in community with. And certainly thank you to my African brother, Lee Robinson, for having me as a guest today. It is always good to be amongst family. I am Reverend T. Sharia Amore Dickerson, and I am the lead organizer and co-founder for Black Lives Matter Oklahoma City Chapter. I do work within the network of the BLM-10, which is a subsidiary of the Black Lives Matter movement, and we are just doing work in Black liberation, increasing Black joy, dispelling and destroying the oppression that comes toward all Black lives, uplifting our people, and increasing collective power in every aspect and in all areas of the world. One most recently, of course, we were able to go and be with our people and our family within Caracas, Venezuela. So, you know, viva la Venezuela. And the movement there of the Afro-descendants and all those that are working for liberation of the people, because we do know that our liberation is bound together.
Sister Sharia, when you went to Venezuela recently in July 2021, you went to attend a particular conference. Can you talk a little bit about the general purpose of the conference, and what was the makeup of the conference, and what were some of the things you learned and got put in the conference?
Sure, I would love to. Before doing that, I think I would be very remiss in not uplifting and calling for support and energy, prayers and vibes, if you are a person of faith, for our beloved Haiti. When we were in Venezuela, I did connect with the Haitian delegation there. We know as a country, they were already dealing with lots of turmoil and calamity. And this morning, Haiti, which had not come back from the previous natural disaster, an earthquake experienced another that was larger and greater on the scale. It was a 7.2. So I am sending a love and asking everyone who is able to reach out, check on our people, make sure that if you can, that you can donate financially to vetted organizations that are going to actually make sure that it is for the people in the area and to restore Haiti. It was certainly felt in the Dominican Republic, felt in Cuba, felt in Jamaica, Puerto Rico, and many other surrounding areas. So I do want to lift that up. That occurred about 4 or 5 hours ago this morning.
Okay, and Sister Sharia, in terms of just a quick suggestion, you have any idea for those who would like to make a contribution, How would it be best to send our money? How would it be best, where would it be best to send it to?
One of the organizations that I support is Beyond Borders. It is a recognized nonprofit, and there are those medical teams that are going in to give medical care. Many people opt to give money to the Red Cross. I know that they are a well-known organization, and I'm certainly not speaking against the work that they have done or the workers themselves. However, the last time that Haiti was hit and the Red Cross raised a considerable amount of money into the millions, the money was not allocated or distributed to the Haitian families and communities. And so I won't say who, but I would say who to do your research and make sure that you are finding organizations that are eligible, have been vetted, are nonprofits, are those that are actually located inside these communities doing the work. If you have connections to Haitian families, make direct donations to your friends. It's not always, some people are concerned, and I understand the necessity of needing sometimes a record and wanting to get credit. But the first thing that I did was reach out to the friends and family that I have in Haiti and said, what do you need? How can I best help you? Several, including a brother that we spent time with, Lee, in Haiti, Shango. Mm-hmm. He let us know that he was okay. He is in the capital city, Port-au-Prince, and he said that that area was not heavily affected and that it was the southern part of Haiti. And he said, I'm going to give suggestions.
And what we can do for our listening audience, if you will email us at mphradio@yahoo.com, we'll give you some reliable sources in terms of where you can send your funds. So email our radio station, mphradio@yahoo.com, and we will send you that information. Thank you for that important information, Sister Cherie. So you can go ahead and tell us about why you were there, how you were there, and what you learned from this conference in Venezuela.
All right. In late June into right the first part of July, I had the privilege and honor of once again visiting the capital city, Caracas, and some other surrounding areas for their bicentennial celebration and the Congress, also focusing around the period to where there was basically rebellion around the celebration of the Carabobo area and the people. And I was there as a guest of several different organizations. First and foremost, my heart and my love standing with the Afro descendants of Venezuela. I said, when black people rise, when Afro descendants rise, we all rise. And so we were connecting with community and our brothers and sisters that are part of that collective. Also was representing the Women's Coalition and working with Gladys Fortuna, who is the Minister of Women, as well as PCOA, which is part of the labor union and the workers' coalition. So I had the honor of having many intersections and organizations that I was working with and had been invited by. This was my second trip into Venezuela within the past year. And so it was an honor, again, to be there and celebrate with them, talk about liberation, and also look at what I think is going to be an international rebellion and uprising of all people who are being oppressed. And it is certainly time. It is time that we stand together and work for the liberation of all of us. I had the opportunity to attend the ALBA Summit, which is where the leadership of, I think, 9 different countries and the southern area around Venezuela, as well as a few countries that are not part of ALBA, but certainly support. And that did include the recently departed President Mose, who is part of that collective. Got to attend that, hear President Maduro, Daniel Ortega, and many, Evo Morales was there, so many, Hector Rodriguez, so many amazing leaders working around uplifting their areas and coming together to stand as one. And I was able to be educated on a lot of things that I did not know about Caracas and the city of La Guaira, where there is a large population of Afro descendants and Black Venezuelans. We visited places like communes. One was a women's commune where women have gone in and occupied that area and turned it into a community in the truest sense of word, where they are self-sufficient, where they support one another, and they make sure that everyone in that community has what they need, and they really work together as a family. I saw part of the PSU party, who really helps navigate and narrate what is happening within Venezuela, especially within the capital city, and was even able to, some of my favorite activities, if you want to call it that, was visiting where the youth orchestra was practicing for a performance they were doing. Young people who are sharing their gifts and talents and bringing the beauty and the impact of art into the lives of many, because art, without art, we do not have civilization. And music, which is part of the artistic world, is international, and it connects us all in every way. So it was a true learning experience for me, Lee. I actually was able to meet you for the first time in person. I know we have worked with Kumbe International, but it was the first time that I got to interact with a lot of my Kumbe family. Shout out to Roema, who is the leader of Kumbe, who is doing an amazing job and holding things together. I was able to engage and be in community with my sister, Dr. Layla Brown, who is doing great and amazing things, is one of my favorite humans and Black women, and one that I try to emulate, and many others, even Brother Amotap Ashante, General Ashante, who is from Jamaica, who also was there. And getting to be able to learn about the various cultures and how we can support one another. It was absolutely one of the most impactful and powerful moments that I have experienced in the totality of my life.
You know, it's interesting you're describing the various Africans from all over the world coming to Venezuela to hold a meeting as reflects the conditions and concerns of African people, not only just within Venezuela, but also throughout the world, throughout the diaspora. Would you talk a little bit about what was it like to have that communication? How did they the Africans coming or born in the U.S. coming to Venezuela, I mean Africans from different parts of the world, how did y'all interact? What were the experiences like in terms of how did they receive you in terms of you being an African, not only an African, but African who taught English? Most of the African was Spanish-speaking people, if I'm not correctly understood. Just give me your response to that dialogue. How was that from your perspective?
So we did have those that had different dialects, Spanish and French being the top two. They had organized a lot of this in very amazing ways, so they had interpreters. But we were able to, there's something about the understanding of the celebration of blackness, that we have our own language. And love is certainly at the core of that for all of our people. So there was a lot of embracing of one another and encouragement. Being able to sit and have communication with the those that were also providing interpretation, Nico and Fabia, Tulio, that were all involved. It was absolutely amazing, and I felt very welcomed. I felt that it was a very inclusive space. I felt that most of us were on the same page and had the same mission about uplifting the fight for Black liberation worldwide. And we also learned how we can better support our family in different areas. We had those from the UK, Spain, France, Italy, that were talking about the type of oppression that they're dealing with. And that expanded my knowledge. I didn't know many of the things that they brought up. But everyone was very welcoming and wanted to share their experience and provide education. And everyone also wanted to learn. We had people from, I think, some from Zimbabwe. We had sisters who were speaking Swahili. And it was just absolutely an honor and a privilege. But I felt very loved, very well accepted and welcomed. And I felt like I was home. It felt like home.
And Cherie, many people know, what is Venezuela? What does it look like? How are the people? Now, let's hone in a little more on Venezuela. When we talk about Venezuela and you talk about the people, what would you say about that phenomenon in terms of the people? What were they like?
They are resilient. They are tenacious. They are absolutely amazing. Warm-hearted, valiant warriors that are the best of what humanity could be. They teach us what being a socialist country or community is all about. They are fierce in their pursuit of making sure that each of their community members have what they need, have what they deserve. So much here in America, what I learned by being over there is distorted. And I learned that the people of Venezuela, they have pride in their country. They love their people. They love themselves. And they just get so much right. They are growing in leaps and bounds in the areas of agriculture. I learned about the space programs that they're a part of. I learned about their military systems and even their systems of law enforcement. Now, I don't particularly engage or am a fan of anything that deals with law enforcement here in the United States. But even there, those that were actually protecting and serving, that's what their law enforcement is doing. And they do not act as an oppression toward the people and do not torment or torture. I was actually in a situation to where I missed the bus on one of the places that I went, and it was law enforcement and other young people who made sure that I was able to get back to where we were staying safely. And there was language barriers, and they still made sure that I was safe. That was a very interesting experience because it's not what we experience here. The women of Venezuela, oh, my goodness. I mean, they have taken over not only communes, but the people have gone into facilities like the Kellogg's facility, and they are running it to make sure when the Kellogg's, when America put pressure on for them to leave, the people of Venezuela said, we are not going to let this building that provides resource and nutrition and finance to our community go to waste. And so they run it. It is absolutely astonishing but inspiring what they're able to accomplish as the people of Venezuela.
You know, Cherie, one of the things you can tell a lot about a country and a government is how it treats its youth and young people and the children. What was your observation of just being in the midst of children and how they interact with people? What did you see? Because still, many people tell you, you know, they paint the narrative of being well, been a real oppressive country. People can't do anything. Everybody's starving to death. The kids not getting what they probably need. Was that the reality that you experienced when you was in Venezuela?
That certainly was not what I witnessed. I witnessed young people in three different settings. One, I've already spoken about the youth orchestra, and these young people who are so talented and gifted that. We're working within, one, they're learning various languages, English being one of them. Five of the young people that I got to sit and talk to, each of them are fluent in four languages, Spanish, English, French, and Portuguese. The others were learning things like German. One said he wanted to learn Patois, which is what we hear our brothers and sisters in Jamaica. One said they had friends in Haiti, and so they were fluent in Creole. So that was amazing, and they were happy and flourishing, but also very aware about the political environment, and they have a thirst and a desire to continue to learn. When we went to some of the communes, young people were doing what our young people in the States here do. They were playing basketball. They were dancing. They were celebrating the bicentennial and historic nature and the Battle of Carabobo at that time. Since we were there, we attended some very religious and spiritual events. To where it was a celebration. And the young people that I saw, even though I knew they are dealing in areas that are impoverished, they were community. I think the youth all over, but especially there, are going to be like the youth that we've seen in many spaces are going to be the leaders and bringing real change to their country. The youth sector, we're very involved in all of the events that we were privy to and participated in. They were leading the celebration, and they have the ear of the leadership, including President Maduro. And President Maduro actually supports and uplifts the youth organizations there. So it was, I was very humbled and very proud to see those young people doing everything and doing it so well.
Now, one of the things from my past experiences of traveling, Cherie, is that you'll find out that many countries that have been rejected as being the enemy to the U.S. are countries that have never done anything to the U.S., and the only thing they want to do is to run and govern their lives as they see fit. For example, we know that Venezuela is on the path of seeking to perfect socialism and understanding more important to make sure the collective survive more so than an individual. Did you find any kind of demeanor or any kind of anti-American behavior from your interaction with Venezuelan people while you were down at these conferences? Did you detect any of that? Because when I was there, the major thing was trying to figure a way of how are they able to make decisions, politically and economically, that will benefit the overall development of their country and our people. That was the driving force of this whole time that, you know, we was over it. From my perspective, what were yours? How did you feel in the aspect of these people being anti-American?
The consistent and constant message that I heard from the people of Caracas and Venezuela was, please take this message and tell what you see, that we are not a violent people, that we are not a defeated people, that we just want the government and the oppressive systems and the imperialist systems of America to take their foot off the necks of Venezuela and the government. They portray President Maduro as someone who is oppositional and adversarial, and that's not what I experienced. He's very funny and comedic and welcoming. And so, again, what I saw was a people who have pride and are very welcoming to others, even to those of us who are Americans who were coming in, and they just want the truth to be told. And they want the beauty and the tenacity and the spirit of their country to be told accurately. And they do want all of those systems that destroy their ability to rise to be removed. But they stand in solidarity with other countries who are dealing with the imperialist systems and capitalist systems of America, like Cuba and Haiti, all of them, Barbados, Mozambique, they're all saying the same thing. Leave us alone. Let us be. Give liberation to these countries, to our people. And that's what I experienced. Those are the messages that I continue to see with those that I stay in contact with. They always say, just make sure that you are telling the truth, that you are telling people what you know about what you witnessed here. And then they always say, please come back and stand with us as many times as you have the opportunity to do so, to continue to give voice to our country.
Okay, before we take this station break, Cherie, can you talk just a little bit to our listening audience, your understanding, your learning of how the U.S. blockade against Venezuela is having an impact on the people there?
What it's doing is it affects the entire country financially. Their infrastructure suffers. Their ability to have import and export from other countries is affected We are literally putting pressure and depleting these beautiful people from having basic resources needed to survive and being able to thrive as a country. They don't have proper food sources. They're not able to expand sustainable sources like in agriculture. Literally, they are such a wealthy country as far as oil. And we take it from them, the United States. We take it from them, give it to other spaces. They add things to it, and then we make them buy it back from us. When I was there in November, and there was the elections, I was serving as an election official, there were lines, I mean miles of cars, and I thought I was witnessing all of these people being in line to vote. And no, these people have to sit in line to get fuel, sometimes for 2 or 3 days. And so their work schedules are you're off for 2 or 3 days because you're trying to get fuel just so you can go to work for the next 2 or 3 days. And the rations that they're given in food and everything, it's heartbreaking. It's offensive. And in it's criminal, in my opinion. So those are the type of things that these blockades and embargoes, it is a dehumanizing process of a people.
But still, they are striving and thriving, and you never will see any people walking around looking hopeless. That was something I didn't see. But what we're going to do right now, Cherie, we're going to take a station break, and when we come back, we're going to open up our phone lines. We would like for you to call in if you have any comments or questions with Cherie. Call in at 818-337-0016. 818-337-0016. One of the things we want to do is try to get a objective perspective, a reality of Venezuela, and educate our people so we can make better choices and force these political politicians over here to make decisions that will help free up our brothers and sisters in Venezuela and other countries that have never done anything to them. So we'll be right back. This is MPH Radio. That's right. We're trying to get rid of this ball of confusion around Venezuela and other countries around the world as it relates to the U.S. behavior, the blockade. Reading an article the other day, they were talking about the U.S. has a blockade policy over just about a third of the world. What's going on with this confusion? And the best way to do this is to get primary information so people can make a lot more objective decisions based upon objective information. Today, we're trying to do this with our sister, Sheree. And at this point in time, we have our lines open. We'd like to encourage you. Anything you want to know about Venezuela and her experiences while she was this past July, please call in at 818-337-0016 and hit 1, and we will acknowledge your last four numbers. Please hit 1. So what we're going to do, we're going to my co-host, Brother Alex. We're coming to you right now. You know, some of the things what our sister had to say about Venezuela. What kind of questions or concerns you may have at this point in time relates to Venezuela? Brother Alex, the mic is yours.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lee. And I appreciate everything that Sheree said today. Gave me a lot of knowledge that I was unaware of. And I deeply appreciate you mentioned to help Haiti, which was the main subject, you know, that I read this morning about. Sometimes in our daily life, we go through a struggle of, you know, what information is right, what information is wrong. And then we have to make good decisions on what to do with our finances and what to do as far as our daily day living. The people of Venezuela has had a tough time, very tough time, because Spain visited them around 1522, and there was much resistance from those indigenous people. And following Haiti in 1811, they became one of the first Spanish-American territories to declare independence from Spain, and one of the first federal republics. So you got to look at a country that full sovereignty around 1830, that decided, like Haiti, that they were no longer going to listen to an oppressor. But yet and still, a few miles north of them was a developing United States of America. And that United States of America had its eyes on the Caribbean and everything it had to offer, as more slaves were traded from that area brought to United States. So in doing so, it was more than a big boy or big brother complex. It was who had the power in the New World. What country would be the one to tell all the others what to do? And so Venezuela was caught in a spot because there were quite a few Africans there. There were quite a few natives there. But they had no voice and no power to do anything. And so they suffered at the hands of other colonial countries. Moving forward, the ideas and thoughts of the United States have not changed much since the times of slavery. We still impose those terror embargoes like she was talking about. It's ridiculous that people have to sit and wait for gas 2 days just to go to work. The care is not there among a lot of our congressional members who could ease these tariffs and embargoes, could trade better, and go down and give aid as they do to other countries, help building schools, providing medical care, giving loans, developing plans such as like the Marshall Plan and different ones that we've supported European countries and Asian countries and helping them build the infrastructure. So we haven't made that investment in the people of color in the new world. United States have always looked over their heads and elsewhere. But I'm so proud that she has brought us this information because our eyes need to be open to what's really going on in the world. And I just can't believe how much stuff goes on that we as everyday American citizens have no idea what's happening. But I'm so glad that you and her, that opportunity to investigate, to sit down and talk at the table, to be able to walk the streets, shake hands with the people, and understand their plight. And I would only like to ask her, if the cooperation, or does she feel the cooperation, or explain to us how that cooperation, as she mentioned, was it better sitting down at the table in the conference in a country many miles away from America than it is sitting down at a conference here in the United States with our own black leaders and trying to get things in the making of a plan to present to someone to say, this is what we need, this is what we need to accomplish, and be organized about it. So I would like to know, how well was that received versus here in America when you're trying to get your point across and you know you need it done, but you find people that are working against you? So if you can answer that, I appreciate it.
Well, that's a loaded question, Alex. But, I mean, simply stated, in the space that we were in Caracas, they were bringing together like-minded persons, activists, revolutionaries, advocates, and those that all care about collective and shared power and collective liberation. So they understood, we all understood what it is to be oppressed, how our country, our government, marginalizes so many in such vast capacity. I mean, our government, our country has longstanding been bullies, and we continue to do that. So sitting at the table with everyone whose mission and goal was the same, it felt, it wasn't as heavy. And it felt like the productivity of the group was very different than that of what I experienced within our country, the United States. I wasn't concerned about the insurrectionists tearing anything apart there, like we witnessed. And the response to that has been very lackluster. I wasn't concerned about having law enforcement and elected officials come in and strong arm the organizations and the sectors all working for the empowerment and betterment of the people. So it was different, and in my opinion, the process I enjoyed more because of the spirit and the solidarity and camaraderie of those at the table. Also being a black, non-gender conforming person who's also clergy, I didn't feel like I was not respected or that my voice was being excluded or muted because of who I am or the hue of my skin. So it was very different. Even sitting, I spoke about the ALBA Summit. I mean, that was started, I think it was 2004, between President Hugo Chavez, who was the president of Venezuela at the time, Viva Chavez, as well as Castro from Cuba. That was when that alliance and that treaty was signed. And then you had all of these other countries come on board about strengthening the alliance against the boycott. They were generating a boycott against the efforts that the United States tries to do with these embargoes and sanctions.
Anything else, Brother Alex?
No, I would like to give the other callers a chance to, you know, call in and see what they have to say. And, you know, because I'm just here to get that information, so I'm passing it on over. Thank you.
Okay.
And you have
to our callers. We're speaking on Venezuela. If you have any questions or would like to ask our guests any question concerning the present realities of Venezuela, this is what we want to do, because we want to get rid of this confusion around Venezuela. Not only what is it, but its relationship to us, why we at oppressed communities should be in solidarity with our brothers and sisters there. So right now, we're going to go to Susie. So we're going to bring Susie in. Susie, any question or comment, please?
Yes. Reverend Cherie, I just have one question, because here in the U.S. we deal with colorism, and it's even increasing with the COVID and everything that's out there. I was just wondering, with your travels in Venezuela, did you see any indication that there also could be an issue with colorism there with this day and time?
Colorism exists everywhere, unfortunately. And speaking with some of the Afro-descendant sisters, they talked about, and some of them have worked as diplomats within the United States. And, of course, with the last atrocious lack of leadership that we had in the previous administration, they were literally thrown out of the country and had to go back. And they talked about how if you had a darker hue, even caramel or paper sack brown skin, that you weren't chosen for positions, as well as those that are fairer skinned. And so colorism is certainly an issue there in Venezuela and in Caracas, and even in all the aspects of the political arenas.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Cherie, what are we going to do? I think we have a sister from Cameroon. I know we have some representing Cameroon at the meeting. We have, I think, a sister from Cameroon. I can bring in Sister Celine. I think that's you, if you can hear me. Say hello. We're speaking to our sister from Venezuela. Welcome, Sister Celine. Can you hear me?
Yes, my brother. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, my sister.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Yes,
I'm happy to hear you. I'm happy to hear you this afternoon. How are you doing over there?
We are moving forward. We're still fighting for United Africa. We're fighting for a free society of all human beings throughout the world. So we're working on it. We're still fighting, sister.
Okay,
we're doing okay.
Thank you.
We're still struggling.
Much. Okay.
Yeah.
Happy to hear that.
You have any comments or any questions you'd like to ask our sister who just came from Venezuela? Speak on her experiences in Venezuela. You have anything you'd like to maybe ask her or say to her?
I don't know much about Venezuela because I don't hear messages from over there. We don't watch the television or hear the radio about Venezuela. So I don't have questions to ask about Venezuela.
But since I do know one thing about you in Venezuela, that y'all have Latin common, y'all two countries, y'all have some revolutionary sisters in the country fighting for the interests of the people. Talk to us a brief a little bit about the work that you are doing as a woman inside of Cameroon, and we can maybe talk about that in relationship to women work in Venezuela. How about that? Share with us about the work that you're doing in Cameroon, and we'll get our sister, Cherie, maybe talk about the work that women is doing in Venezuela. Okay, go ahead, Sister Celine.
Okay, my name is Naya Lekunze Celine.
Yeah, we want you. We can hear you.
Okay, I am from Cameroon. I am the president of the Mundane Believing Women Roots and Tubers Cooperative. Our cooperative, what we do is we try to empower the women. We try to have some, we bring up income generating activities which we train the women. And we also take care of the needy children. We empower the girl child to go back to go to school, because it's difficult for female children to be sent to school. So it's a battle for us trying to educate the female children. Because of the crisis, we have so many children.
I think we just lost our caller for some reason or another. So what we can do right now, Cherie, can you just talk a little bit about the history and struggle of Afro-Venezuelan, and also tying to the question of the role of women in Venezuela. You mentioned earlier some of the things they were doing, but you might want to add some more. But at least talk a little bit about this whole history and struggle of Afro-Venezuelan people, and how is that related to the overall struggle inside and outside of Venezuela, from your perspective?
What I experienced was the intentional and deliberate amplification of the voices of women within the country of Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
All over, black and brown women are often dismissed. Their service and what they literally contribute is co-opted, and they are not given credit. And so I see Venezuela making a true effort to change that and to acknowledge the great contributions of women from the beginning of the history, the founding of that great country. And kudos. But I did, I had a conversation with the leaders in the ALBA Summit and some others, and I was like, you know, there are no women at the table. If you are truly about what you say you're about, then you're going to, if you have to, you will step aside and give women the rightful and well-deserved positions. One, when you have women who are organizing, and women have always been the backbone of most of the movement. We may not be the faces of the movements, but we certainly are the ones that really are the oil and the glue that make things happen. And so they're being very, very intentional in acknowledging that and empowering the women organizations and those advocates and revolutionaries to be able to continue that great work.
Okay. What we're going to do right now, let's take another caller right here. We have caller 4298. Caller, we're going to bring you in 4298. Any comments or questions for Cherie?
Thank you. That's a very interesting comments. Observations that she's been making about the struggle in Venezuela, and I would hope that the people of Venezuela will be able to overcome the little trouble they're having right now and come together in unity around the socialist revolution. And I don't know that I have any questions I just hope that things get better. Thank you.
Okay. Sheree, you know, one of the things you alluded to earlier, you said, I think it's maybe your second time being in Venezuela. You were over there a year ago or so dealing with the elections. Can you speak to this myth about there's no democracy in Venezuela? And what was that election process like based upon your observation, particularly in terms of participation of the people? We noticed if you look at probably the last 15 to 20 elections inside U.S. national elections, they have now received over 50% of the population that is eligible to vote. Give me your take and your understanding of what you saw around this whole question of people participating and making choices that that are directly related to their interests inside of Venezuela.
The commitment to voter participation and registration was inspiring, and their process and the technology that they use it surpasses what we have here in the United States. One of the ways that they verify identity is through biometrics using a fingerprint, and so it basically prohibits voter fraud, and that's not something that they have to work against or work, you know, around during an election. It's also almost instantaneous. They knew basically by the end of the day on most of the elections by the way that they do it. Now, something that I personally witnessed, and I was so humbled. I literally wept. There was a gentleman who told me, he was 79, and when he came up, we were there, the group of, they were in an international group of election observers, and we began to speak to him, and he spoke a little bit of English. I speak very poor Spanish, but we had interpretation, and he had walked 4 miles in the heat at 79 to vote, because that's how important it was for him. And I know that many of those before us, our elders, have gone through great battles to be able to exercise our right in voting. But here in 2021, here was this man who was walking 4 miles in the heat, who did have some health concerns because of how important voting was. And he had pride that he said he had, in the last 40 years, he had never missed voting in an election. And it didn't matter if he had to walk 4 miles or 10 miles. And so for him, he walked 4 miles there, had to turn around and go back 4 miles. And he was going back to the car that he was actually sitting in waiting for fuel for his son, because his son had to leave the vehicle to try to go to work. But the voting process was far more streamlined and easy. And we went during the voting, and then we went back at the end when they were tallying the votes, and saw how the machines literally, after they basically provide the information on ticker tape, kind of like what we have here. I do work in the election process here in Oklahoma. I am a member of the Oklahoma Democratic Party, so I know how we collect. It was very similar. But their information is also uploaded in a different manner to where it was more accurate. So it was interesting to see.
Okay, Sheree, we're going to go back to that sister from Cameroon right quick. Let her get it, finish her thought. We can bring in sister, my sister from Cameroon. We brought you back in. You were talking about the role of the work of women in Cameroon. Sister Naya, you can continue your presentation on the role of women.
Okay, thank you. I'm happy to hear how the elections was carried out in Venezuela. We too in Cameroon, even now we are going through elections. We have our party elections going on in Cameroon right now. For now, the women in Cameroon are struggling to hold peace talks concerning the crisis in the Northwest and Southwest region. So I just came back from a meeting where we are struggling how we can also alleviate the poor people from poverty, holding some training on poverty elevation in Cameroon, in the whole of the country. I also won elections last year, and now I'm the member of the regional council in Cameroon, where we sit down and discuss things concerning the development of our regions and our divisions. So can I call myself an activist, a leader of the women? So it's a struggle. Because of the crisis, the women are really poor. So many children are scrambling, asking me to sponsor them in school because that's what we have been doing. And it's very difficult on our side. It's very difficult. I have about 200 names that children have sent to me that they want me to sponsor them, go back to school. Schools are starting in September. So I'm really stressed up. I'm really feeling bad. I don't know how I can go about with such a business, sending back those children to school. Yeah, we are trying our best. Back here in Cameroon, the women are struggling, asking for peace, doing peaceful marches so that the government can bring peace and the separatists can also sit down and discuss so that peace should return in our country. So those are the difficulties we are going through. But we believe one day it will be fine.
Okay, my sister Celine, we'd like to thank you for giving us an update on what's going on in Cameroon. What we'll do with you at a later date, we'll do a special feature on Cameroon, and we will bring you back, and we'd like to thank you for your participation. Okay? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for hearing from us from Cameroon. Thank you for hearing
Sister Sheree, one of the things we know that at this particular conference during this past summer, there was a call for African people to begin to look at ourselves globally and to connect our struggles and our issues. Just like we just heard the issues of the problems that the people in Cameroon face, you'll probably find no problems among our people all over the world. And we can, and we can witness, some of that in Venezuela. Now, speaking of the Venezuela, they have made a call that they want more Africans to connect and be in solidarity with them. From your participation, what are some of the things they would like maybe for Africans to do on the outside to further strengthen our relationship with our brothers and sisters in Venezuela and around the Venezuela Revolution? Can you hear me, Sister Sheree?
I can now. I didn't hear the question, though, Lee. I'm sorry.
Yeah, what are some of the things we can do for the Venezuela, the brothers and sisters from Venezuela? Is part of the meetings that took place in July was also around the question of solidarity, the question of connecting our struggles and how we can become supportive toward each other. In the case of Venezuela, I was asking you from your perspective, what are some of the things we can do, those outside of Venezuela, the Africans and other countries around the world? What are some of the things we can do to better strengthen our relationship and support each other?
Some of the things that we can do, especially in countries where there is distorted or intentional media haze around what's mm-hmm. actually happening, we can be very intentional and diligent in making sure that the truth is being told, that we are educating ourselves on what's really happening and sharing that information. We can dispel the misinformation around what's happening to our brothers and sisters in these countries. We can find organizations and connect them with our organizations, and we can ask the impacted communities that we're wanting to support, what is the best way to support them? So don't make the decision based on what we want to do. Ask what they need and follow through in doing those things. And be consistent in how we stand in solidarity, and continue to connect, contact and demand our government that they remove or end these sanctions and these blockades. We need to continue to do that and protest and disrupt.
You know, Sister Sheree, one of the things I learned when I was there was we're talking about the impact of the U.S. blockade in Venezuela. One of the things that people need to understand is that Venezuela's historical development economically in terms of its very means of producing inwardly. The one of the things Venezuela found itself in was historically has been like what they call a monocrop economy. They basically had one major crop where they basically drew down, you know, gotten their resources from in terms of producing, which in this case is oil. And it's unfortunate that when you look at this whole question of oil, they would depend on U.S. technology and expertise to be able to produce and manufacture oil and gas. And when we talk about oil, one of the things I didn't know, I didn't know there was some type of chemicals you need to have in order to put in the oil to produce gas. But unfortunately, the kind of chemicals that you need to do this, those chemicals was all inside of U.S. So the U.S. has been able to lock out, you know, these chemicals from Venezuela, which is making it very difficult for them to produce gas. Also, when you look at the different kind of pots and labels that you need for these equipment, most of these pots and labels, again, are tied into the U.S. The U.S. can dominate and control the productions of these types of equipment that's needed. So it becomes very difficult to operate when you have economies that have been based upon basically one single item, and these items are solely tied into under control of a foreign country. So that's one of the difficulties that countries are having in trying to break out this economic relationship and dependency, you know, on the U.S. So our people just need to understand that. They need to also understand that a lot of the current national debt of Venezuela that was outside of the country has been confiscated and taken over by the U.S. and by the U.S. government and Europe, England. It was reported that they have so many $1 billion worth of gold in London, England, that's owed to the Venezuelan people, which was their original wealth, where England has taken it under pretext of certain rules and policies of the U.S. It's been understood that even with the oil companies that were functioning inside the United States, the U.S. government has taken over these kind of countries and the resources from it and given to individuals who is collaborating with them. So I'm saying in terms of looking at the difficulties of this blockade, I think that American people need to definitely take some time to investigate and find out and understand who are the major players that are participating in this form of what we call a low-intensity warfare, because that's what blockades are. Most people don't recognize that. They are low-intensity warfare against a country. So in terms of understanding that particular dynamic, you know, would be maybe advocate, what would be some of the things that maybe people inside of the United States could look at politically to put pressure on different kind of institutions and powerful individuals to act in a just and fair and responsible way of giving back Venezuela the necessary resources that rightfully belongs to them. What are some of the things we can do to change the dynamic to put an end to this blockade against Venezuela? You have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't think that the humanity of a person, a people, a country is ever up for debate. And so we literally are asking the government officials and leaderships of this country to do the right thing, do the ethical thing, do the humane thing, and stop participating in the systems of imperialism. Stop allowing capitalism to dehumanize and destroy a people. Be a person of ethics and integrity. This new administration said that is exactly who they were, and that they were going to look at many things that the previous administrations and many of those before them had done, and that they were going to rectify it. So we're asking them to do what they said they were going to do, to keep the promises that they made when they were vying to be elected, and to treat people like people, simple dignity and respect, and to do it immediately. There is no need for this to continue any longer. It has been decades that we have participated in these atrocious systems.
Okay, Sheree, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take some break, and when we come back, we're going to have you give your final thoughts on this theme today, visiting Venezuela and learning. And when she does that, we will make our final thoughts for the day, and this will be MPH Radio program for the day. So right now, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, Sister Sheree will give her final thoughts on the subject matter. This is MPH Radio.
Education, 'cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense.
God heal for all underserved communities. Welcome back to MPH Radio. We're going to be making that closing mark today on the theme, Visiting Venezuela and Learning. We are here with Sheree Omoro Dickerson. She's a representative of the Black Lives Matter chapter of Oklahoma. She just recently came back from Venezuela, so we're trying to get a first-hand perspective, a primary perspective on the reality of Venezuela. She will now just give us some final thoughts on this subject matter today, and we bring Sheree. We bring you back in your final thoughts on the subject matter.
My final thoughts are that we as a community of black and brown people, us that understand what it is to have to fight against the tyranny of governmental overreach and improper and abusive use of power and the systems of racism, white supremacy, and the destruction that it brings, that we truly commit to standing in solidarity with the people and the government of Venezuela in fighting for their liberation, understanding that when we help and liberation is achieved in one aspect of our family, it brings liberation for all of us. I left a part of my heart in Caracas. I am excited to return. I encourage everyone to, again, expand your knowledge about what is happening and learn about the beautiful people and country of Venezuela and do all that you can to help them, to help our brothers and sisters in Haiti and Cuba, so that we all rise.
And on that note, my sister, we'd like to thank you for your perspective and the information that you have brought forward today and helping us to fill in our missing page of history as relates to visiting Venezuela and learning. We thank you. Next, we'll go to Susan for her final thoughts for the night. Susan, your final thoughts for tonight. I got to think we had some difficulties with Susie. We'll go with Brother Alex. Brother Alex, your final thoughts for tonight. Brother Alex.
Well, I hate we can't get in touch with Susie, but I would like to wish her a final happy birthday because she made black history also the day she was born. So I want to celebrate that moment. But moving on to Sheree, it's been a very informative day. And I would cherish it and go back and do more diligent research because that's what we have to do to find out where we are, where we're going, how far can we go, and let no one tell us what we can do and put chains on us ever again. It was so important, her mentioning, to get to the ballot box again. It was just not a one-time thing. As she said, the gentleman walked 4, 5, 6 miles, 8 miles, round trip, 10, 15, whatever it takes for us to get to the ballot box so that our voices, our opinions are heard. Because that's the only way that things are changed. Even though the rules are being changed, we have to look past the rules and move forward. So I'm just intrigued by all the information I picked up and learned today. And I'm going to take a lot of this to heart. And like I say, go ahead and review, and listen to this program again. And just make sure that I'm more knowledgeable about what's going on in the world through all these embargoes and tariffs that are being put on the people of colors, nations, and why it's taken them so long to rise. But we have to have some support among each other. We have to band with these different countries that are in these hardships imposed by the United States and other countries. And we have to work with our elected officials to bring about change, because it's not fair. It wasn't fair 200 years ago, and it's not fair today. But we have to move forward and with this struggle. And I thank you again for being here today, and I thank you, Mr. Lee, for being able to present her today.
And we'd like to thank you, Alex, Susie, our special guests, our listening audience, our friends and supporters, for allowing MPH Radio to come to your home this evening. And we'd like to remind you that this is a program that comes on a bi-weekly basis every Saturday, every other Saturday, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S. Our next program will be on the 28th of August at 1 p.m. Please write that down and share that with your friends. We'd like to remind you that, brothers and sisters, we are part of the human family. We must act as human beings and be respectful to each other as human beings. We must know that any time when we see justice, when time when we see injustice, we must fight against it. Because as Brother Dr. Martin Luther King taught us, a threat of justice anywhere is a threat to injustice everywhere. We must remember that and look at that as we think about the blockade against Venezuela and our brothers and sisters there. Even when we fail unjust, you must raise our voices if we don't have nothing else and say, end the blockade now against Venezuela. So until next time, let's continue our ways to strive to go forward ever and backwards never. And the best way we can do this is to help come and join us, work with us, and help us to continue to fill in our missing pages of history. So come, join us. Let's get on this front line. We'll see you on the 28th of August. Thank you.
You're gonna